This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and Alice Fullwood, the Wall Street correspondent for Economist Magazine, is helping me understand the brave new world. Well, let's put it this way. The extremely anxious new world of banking and this other thing. Used to be easy to say it was shadow banking, but it's not even that anymore. It's digital. And before we go to the idea of digital currency, Bitcoin, all of that, I want to stop it at Silicon Valley, or the large understanding of the launches of startups that make billionaires out of 25-year-olds. Alice, it was unknown to me to think about this, but Silicon Valley and banking do not work well together. Or let us put it this way. The history is Silicon Valley has access to other kinds of capital. What capital? And is that a good thing? And is Silicon Valley satisfied that they don't go to a money center bank and say, give me a loan?
Just to zoom back a little bit, the history of banking and sort of capitalism and business creation are very closely intertwined. You know, before banks were there to provide funding for business creation, it didn't really happen anywhere near as easily. And they play a sort of very, very important role in funding those sort of processes of creation and destruction that sort of drive economies forward and help sort of foster economic growth. So, you know, if you think about where businesses are being created in modern economies, you think of Silicon Valley, you think of the sort of big software and tech firms that are all sort of born, as you say, and create billionaires out of 25-year-olds. Now, the important shift that's happened in the way that businesses in the things that businesses create over the last sort of 100 years or so, change the ability of banks to be able to finance new businesses today. So businesses used to make physical capital. You know, you wanted to make car parts for Ford. So you'd create sort of machinery that could do that. And you could borrow from a bank to build those machines because it was a physical thing that the bank could come and seize if you stopped paying back your loan. Silicon Valley doesn't create machines. They create software. They create intellectual property. And so you can't really securitize a loan against that. So instead, you have to be funded by equity capital for the most part. So this is the rise of VC. And venture capital has become this hugely important source of financing for modern economies, in particular in America. Something like half of the companies listed on the S&P 500 were once initially funded by Silicon Valley. Once initially funded by venture capital in Silicon Valley.
And so banking is, does banking think it missed out because of the regulators? In other words, let's go back to the Bob Hope joke. Somebody with a better idea, say, named Zuckerberg, goes into a bank and says, I have this idea that everybody wants to network and watch television on my website. And the banker would go, okay, but there's nothing physical there. What do I look at? What can I kick a tire? And it doesn't work out. And so venture capitalists show up. Is that okay with banking, or does banking blame regulators that they won't let us do this and so shrug?
I don't think it's necessarily this in particular is not the regulators' fault. This is just a reflection of how the world has changed. You know, banks, every time a bank makes a loan, it has to worry about being repaid. And the best way to not have to worry about that is to get some valuable collateral, like a machine or a car or a house or something. And if the firms of today aren't creating that kind of collateral, then there's not that much that banks can do about it. You do see sort of some more flexible banks. There's a sort of specialized bank in Silicon Valley that does this, that tries to get its arms around doing intellectual property, loans secured on intellectual property. But, you know, I don't know that it's one of these sort of interesting things. I don't know that it's anyone's fault. It's just the world has changed and made it harder for the sort of traditional model of banking to deal with this.
And miss out on a huge profit. I mean, those firms bring in a lot of whales every year. All right. Digital currency. It sounds utopian. One digital currency for all. You tell a wonderful story in your presentation about the ability to enter into all kinds of fun things and eat food in Washington, D.C. using Alipay, which is based in the People's Republic of China. Is there a rush towards one digital currency for all, sort of like, you know, Lord of the Rings, one ring brings them all together? Or are all currencies now experimenting with digital? So there'll be an array of digital possibilities when you arrive at an ATM.
So, you know, the platforms that we were talking about earlier, it's very clear to everyone that they're sort of, it's best if there's one ride-hailing app, right? Because then it's easiest to get a ride. One social media app, because then all of your friends are on it. The same is true of digital currencies and money. You know, it's easier to use money if everyone uses the same money. And for, you know, the history of sort of modern currency, most countries have had their own currency that's been managed by their own central bank and print, they can print their own money supply. But as digital payments go global, you do sort of raise this sort of interesting prospect that actually, if you make it so easy to send money across borders, as these sort of tech platforms are trying to do, then perhaps the boundaries of currency areas, you know, no longer stop at nation states. And it's possible to think that sort of one tech platform, possibly Alipay, but possibly somebody else, you know, like Facebook is trying to come up with its own digital money, called Diem, which will be pegged to the dollar probably. That, you know, one payment platform provider, one digital money could eventually win out. And that could be the dollar, but it also could be another currency. It could be the Chinese. They're certainly furthest ahead in the provision of digital money.
Yes, you now we're into vision of the world in 100 years from now. Is there a centralizing a prejudice here? In other words, does Zuckerberg's son run everything? Does Xi Jinping's children run everything? Or are we seeing everybody understanding a multiplicity of banks, London, plus Beijing, plus Paris is an advantage, a multiplicity of digital. Have they made a choice yet to your learning, Alice?
So I think it depends how difficult it is to use sort of existing smaller ecosystems versus the larger one. So what you've seen, sort of one of the interesting dynamics in the provision of central bank digital money, so this is central banks trying to sort of create digital coins to for their citizens to use, is that the countries that are furthest along on that path are all of the sort of smaller emerging market economies that have quite open economies, the ones that are the most ripe for disruption by sort of global centralized currency, perhaps like the dollar or the yuan or the euro even. And, you know, they're trying to act defensively to make it as easy as possible for their citizens to keep using their own domestic currency and therefore to deter them from potentially moving to a sort of centralized global currency. I think that makes total sense as the way that they are thinking about this and why they're doing what they're doing. But it's very difficult to say whether that will be sort of enough of a deterrent to prevent people from switching to a global currency in the future.
We've not mentioned privacy because it's implicit that there is no privacy here. Is that a concern for the regulators at this point, that making this amount of data available because you want a loan or because you've made a purchase means that you have no – liberty is challenged. Let me put it diplomatically.
This is a huge concern. This is the biggest, I think. You know, the last 100, 200 years of banking has been all about financial stability problems. The world that we're describing, where sort of everyone uses digital money and everything leaves a trail, and the trail that you leave becomes data upon which you can secure loans, or is the information via which people decide whether or not you can have a mortgage to buy a house. Perhaps the trail that you're leaving doesn't just go through America anymore. It also goes through China or Europe or through servers that aren't located in the country that you live in. You know, this sort of universe raises a whole host of problems for sort of individual privacy. You know, do you want a private company to have all of this information, or do you want the government to have it? I mean, you might not want either, but if it's one private company or a government, then certainly you would probably rather have regulated, sort of highly regulated control of that data. And if you have to pick sort of one government, you'd much rather it was a sort of the US government rather than the Chinese. So the topics that regulators will have to grapple with, the questions they're facing are, you know, how do you protect individuals in this world?
Alice Fullwood is the Wall Street correspondent for The Economist magazine. I'm John Batchelor, and I bank at 1984. This is CBSi on the World.